For the next hour, we'll be doing geek news and talking about Mac OS X Tiger from the Unix perspective, and maybe throwing a little bit of Perl just to round out our geekiness.
GeekSpeak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's Friday, December 16th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California, and of course, it is time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, after Spot of Geek News, we'll be speaking with, now I've got the book in front of me, Andy Lester, yes, the author of Mac OS X Tiger in a nutshell, a Unix perspective, if you will, on OS X. We'll also be talking a little bit about Perl, the programming language. He happens to be an expert on that, and I've enjoyed speaking with them over the last week, so I hope you will as well. But that'll be about 15 minutes from now. During the second half of the show, we'll invite you to participate in the conversation, whether it be questions of technology or additional comments regarding our topic. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Geek Miles Elam, technical trainer for Surf Control. Miles, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning, Lyle.
Before we get into our discussion about the technical side of OS X Tiger, and in general Macintosh OS X, and a little bit about Perl, let's do some geek news of the week. And since you're the only geek here, I'll start with you.
Well, I'll start off with a joke that was played on me yesterday.
Who played that joke on you?
I have no idea. Basically, I get an instant message from Lyle telling me, hey, look up gullible in the Wikipedia. And so I, go to this link, and it has a picture of me.
You know, it just makes sense. You look up gullible in the dictionary, and this picture of you. The other thing... So what happened is in the last 2 weeks, we've been talking about lots of news about Wikipedia being a resource for disinformation, possibly. Then there was a great article yesterday, I think, in the New York Times about how actually reliable the resource is.
Well, with regard to science topics.
With regard to science topics, right.
Technology, yes.
And what I decided to do was test out this whole thing we keep on hearing about, that you can't create a page unless you're a user, and how complicated it is, what's the interface like. So I looked up a word that didn't happen to be there, and I created the page, but totally anonymously, from what I understood, which meant that, my first take on that was that this information about you have to log in to create an entry is wrong. But what I figured for after that, in trying to get more information on Gullible, I added an entry, Miles Elam. I couldn't add the entry, Miles Elam, without creating an account and logging in. Now, of course, this was a test. I knew this information would get deleted really quick. And this morning, is Gullible up still?
No, it was already taken down within 12 hours of putting it up.
Good.
That's also something in Wikipedia's favor, is that there was a mistake. Or
people,
an erroneous entry,
sure.
Yeah.
And gullible, I mean, as my wife said, is not a word that should be in an encyclopedia. It's a word that should be defined in a dictionary. I can't remember the Wikiary. I think there's a dictionary version of encyclopedia.
Yeah.
It was nice to know that got repaired. I think that was that's fundamental.
Right, and that was actually something that Wikipedia founders were talking about, which was it isn't so much trying to make sure that everything is correct on the first try, but a improvement over time and the ability to add in a large amount of information very quickly.
I was speaking about this topic with my coworker, and was his first take on it is, yeah, Wikipedia is totally unreliable. It's the worst way to share information. I said, actually, isn't it the best way to share information in a lot of ways? If you take a book, which we're really used to, if you take an encyclopedia book, it is very possible for an error to exist in that book.
And they do exist.
They exist all the time, right? It's less common for an error to exist on that than on a thing that's editable by multiple people, I think. But it does.
Or by the population at large.
Right. And the thing is, normally in good resource books, there'll be a large bibliography of other books that are used as reference. So you can track down the information. Do people actually do that? I don't know. But what's nice about the Wikipedia site is that the additional information can be anybody can participate in adding it. There can even be arguments, if you will, on that. One of the things that's supported on each Wikipedia page is a discussion about the page. And that's kind of like, well, should we take it into this realm? You know, there's other use of this word. Should we talk about there? It's kind of sidelined to the information. So it's, I personally love the resource.
Right. And that actually brings up other topics with regard to Wikipedia, and that some people that are in the field itself, either historians or anthropologists or the like. Like I said, it's mostly the non-science related fields that Wikipedia has taken so much flack that there has been criticism that it has been a consensus as opposed to, or a consensus, in other words, the layman and the academic, as opposed to someone who has actually spent so much time in the field getting priority.
Right.
So that has been an issue in the past. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks. I just want to mention that Andy Lester is on the phone right now with us. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Lyle. Hi, Miles.
Andy, you're welcome to participate in our news segment. We're going to keep on going. Miles, what's your next story for the day?
You know, well, let me throw one thing in on Wikipedia. I think Wikipedia's real big problem that they're going to run into is copyright more than anything.
Yeah, that would be an issue.
You know, I mean, there's only so many times you can post the pictures of Counselor Troy or the X-Men mm-hmm. before you start running afoul of, you know, that goes well beyond fair use.
Right.
And it's funny to see, you know, all content here is in the public domain or covered by the GDPL, but that's simply not the case.
Right.
That, to me, I think will be the downfall of Wikipedia more than anything.
You'll definitely see a turn, a legal, you know, somebody will argue that that needs to get removed, and then there will be a lawsuit, and then Wikipedia will have to change its entire practice on what media is available. I'm curious, even not just the information regarding, you know, pictures and other media files that are duplications of someone else's work, but even the content. I mean, the character Deanna Troi, right, is a copyrighted thing, probably trademarked. So it's interesting to see that being put in. Though it is
just to think of it, that picture of me, that's copywritten. You're not allowed to use that.
You know, I linked to that picture, so yeah, take me to court, Miles. Okay, yeah, good point, Andy. Thank you. Let's go on to the next news story.
With the Hubble telescope, scientists have discovered the exact mass, or for all intents and purposes, the exact mass of a white dwarf, the closest white dwarf to the Earth, which is Sirius B, next to Sirius A, also known as the Dog Star. And this is important in that this has been a debate that's been going on for 140 years as to how exactly do white dwarfs develop, how are they formed, what is their exact mass, can we prove this, does this follow our models? And our own sun in 5 billion years will become a white dwarf when its nuclear fuel is exhausted.
I've finished doing my laundry.
But what it turns out is this item is about 12,000 kilometers in diameter, about the same as the Earth, and yet is 98% of the mass of the sun.
Ooh, that's
so. So it ends up, if you were standing on the surface of this white dwarf, it would be 350.
Really, really hot.
Well, yes, sorry. But 350,000 times the gravity of the Earth.
Yeah, that's a lot. So you'd be flat and hot. Wow, that's pretty dense. That's
there's some, but not gullible. There's some like
not gullible. All right, your next item in.
a report released by the Harvard Medical School is saying that carpal tunnel syndrome is not related to keyboard usage, or at least not the keyboard usage commonly associated with the workplace. In other words, about approximately 7 hours a day in front of a computer. What they're finding is that it is more due to things like genetics, other history, even links to pregnancy.
Links to pregnancy? What do you mean?
I have no idea. I haven't actually read the report.
Miles, you're supposed to be prepared for this, man. We're
but it was saying by heredity, body weight.
I fathered a child.
Yeah, heredity, body weight, fracture, or even pregnancy is what the statement is talking about. But it was saying don't go typing to your heart's content. It's still saying that improper computer use will cause injury.
Uh-huh.
And you shouldn't necessarily throw away that gel insert, that, you know, that wrist rest that's there. That can always help.
I always read the little warning sticker on my keyboard every day before typing as sort of a reminder.
Yeah. But at the same time, those wrist braces I have may cause more damage. In that they restrict blood flow, which may contribute to more damage than the carpal tunnel that you're trying to prevent or to treat.
You know, I spend a lot of time on the computer, and some weeks I'll have a lot of discomfort and realize that I've changed something about my environment, and I slowly fix my, you know, repair myself over time. It's definitely something you need to be very conscious of. And there's whole hints and tricks about it. Let's not get into all the ways to use a keyboard correctly, but it would be maybe an interesting topic for the show.
Hey, Doc, it hurts when I go like this.
Don't do that
anymore.
Right. I mean, there you go.
Yeah, but doing it is necessary for my job.
Bummer.
Yeah.
All right. You got another one, Miles?
Yes.
Okay.
BMW has unveiled what they call a turbo steamer. This has to do with, usually with an internal combustion engine or a turbocharger, you're running this, you're basically exploding fuel. Controlled explosions generates heat, and you know, you turning a turbine, and a lot of that excess heat just goes out through the exhaust pipe.
Isn't that wasteful?
Yeah. Well, what they're talking about with the turbo steamer is using all of that excess heat and using it as a steam engine. Going to a controlled steam engine, it will turn a turbine and add what they're estimating at 15% extra power.
Wow.
Without any real downside. In other words, you're reusing the heat that you've already generated in the car and reducing the amount of heat exiting out the exhaust pipe by 80%.
Nice, nice. Well, great. Thank you, Miles, for letting us know. Are you going to modify your car?
Not anytime soon. Automotive engineer.
It's funny. It seems like, you know,
to hear about. Like,
from a physics perspective, it's an obvious thing to do. You know, that there's some wasted heat coming out there. Let's use it.
But when you said steamer, I thought we were going to be able to cook broccoli on the way home.
You definitely could, right?
You probably could.
Well, thank you, Miles, for the geek news today. I appreciate
it. But in terms of like talking about the hydrogen hydrogen fuel or, you know, other types of fuel generation, it's interesting hearing about these incremental changes to the existing line of cars, because it doesn't require a major change to the design of, for example, the BMW car series, that it can just do this incremental change to get an improvement.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for doing the news with me. It's Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control. He's going to stay with us for the rest of the show. Well, we're going to be talking with Andy Lester about his new book, but also about other things. So in March of 2001, I believe, Apple introduced OS X to widespread acclaim, I would say. The Unix-based operating system has brought in new geeky users over to Apple's offerings, and Andy here is joining us. Andy, I would assume that you are a Unix geek.
Yes.
That's the right way to go about it, right?
Yes.
And I had a really wonderful experience with this. I speak with a lot of O'Reilly. I get all the press releases about O'Reilly's offerings. O'Reilly's by far my favorite computer publishing company. And I'm always getting the press releases. And when I saw this book coming out, I was like, this is great. We have so many callers calling about OS X questions, a lot of Mac callers. I'm not sure why we have so much Mac callers on the show. Maybe because
we're pushing it every
Maybe week. We push it all the weekend on it. Maybe because I've got a Mac in front of me, that it might help, right?
And you're how far from Cupertino?
That might be it, too, right. So, in any case, we get a lot of that, and I thought it would be nice to tie in an O'Reilly book with a topic that's really of interest. So when I talked to you last week, I said, so we'll talk about, you know, you said, what are we going to talk about? I said, well, we'll talk about OS X. And you said, I don't even like Macintosh. I'm like, what? And so I started realizing that the thing that is so appealing to a lot of geeks about the operating system is something that is kind of a dynamic opposition to what Macintosh traditionally is. When I first opened up a Macintosh computer, Plus, I think it was, it couldn't do anything except for what the operating system made you do. The applications could run. You couldn't see the background. You couldn't participate in it. There was ResEdit and a few other things that allowed you to do some things. But in general, it was like tying your hands down from a computer perspective. You were experiencing the operating system the way the designers had intended. That's it.
And there was no command line.
No command line.
I mean, even Windows had a command line.
Right. Not the best command
line.
Well,
the command line came before Windows. But
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So when I started thinking about your response saying you didn't even like Macintosh until OS 10, I realized that that's the real story here, is that when they ported over to BSD, the Unix flavor that Macintosh is based on, they ushered in a whole bunch of geeks into participating in the operating system, and that's one of the major reasons it's been taken off. So, Andy, what was your experience when you first saw OS 10?
Well, I've been doing Windows stuff or Unix stuff for over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very comfortable with it, with Unix and Linux and Solaris and all the variants. It's my preferred way of working has been. I'm very into Perl, which comes from a Unix background as well. And
for the audience out there, Perl is a programming language.
Yes, Perl is a programming language, and it's
pathologically eclectic rubbish lister.
That's its acronym, yes.
Say it again.
Pathologically eclectic rubbish lister. Okay, actually, it's practical extraction and reporting language, but okay. I like pathologically eclectic rubbish.
So Andy, you've been using Unix, and you like Perl a lot, which is nice for a command line.
Right, there's nothing like that for the Mac.
Right.
There is Mac. There's been Mac Perl. Chris Nander has driven that for quite a while, and there was really no power interface.
So when you looked
into OS 9 or the previous operating system.
So you basically ignored them as an operating system choice for
yes,
you.
Yes. Right. Yes. Always have.
And so did every other Unix person in the world.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm sitting here using Windows for my pretty GUI, and I'm using command line Linux for my Unix needs.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw OS 10, and I saw that I had a pretty interface that ran, real apps, that I could run Word or whatever mainstream GUI apps I needed, and I had that Unix back end, I was in love. And that's all there was to it. And I went out and I got an iBook, and the rest is history. We're now a Windows-free home.
A Windows-free home, wow. Do you feel cleaner in the morning when you wake up?
I do. Showers are shorter.
The sun's a little warmer on the cold days.
This is going bad.
So the thing is that's great about your book is that it really is you're a Unix person. You're now on a Macintosh. What are all the different commands? What are the things that are different? And I want to start talking about that. So that's what we're doing today. First off, what's really been frustrating out of me is this thing that happens when I use a lot of command line utilities because I do Perl to my workflow for recording the show and getting a podcast up involves doing a higher compression of MP3 so that we have horrible sounding podcasts. That's really important. Actually,
okay.
it's to reduce bandwidth. It's to reduce bandwidth. But in any case, I do a lot of command line stuff. And one of the things that happens when you do a lot of command line stuff in the Macintosh environment is you start seeing these invisible files that have similar names to other files in the same directory. They start with a dot and an underscore.
Uh-huh.
What are those?
Those are your resource fork files. And it is one of the things that's been a problem is that the Unix commands have ignored the resource forks. Really, it's a separate file. It's almost a shadow file.
But what is it? What is a resource fork?
It is the pretty stuff, the icons and the information about the sort of meta information about the data.
So it's when
goes with it. It's a partner to it. And through the GUI, you go and the GUI melds the two together. The data is over here, and the resource information is separate. But in the command line, you don't see them as separate.
So that's been the problem. So in the GUI, yeah, that's right. When I open the Finder up, when I see a folder, I never see these files. But is this the information that allows me to show an icon view and move the icons around, and every time I open the folder, the icons are still in the same place?
Right. All of that pretty stuff that the GUI interface needs to know about the file is in there. And one of the things that's, that with versions of OS X before Tiger, is that the command line utilities, CP, MV, TAR, et cetera, that, you know, all the Unix guys know and love, do not preserve those resource forks. They don't. And with Tiger, the commands, those commands are now aware of and respect the resource forks. It's still two separate files from the Unix point of view, but if you copy a file, it's going to copy the resource fork for you automatically.
Nice. Now, when and I'm assuming this issue of having this separate file that's hidden in the Unix system is a side effect of porting over the traditional Macintosh operating system file structure onto a Unix file structure.
Right.
So this information of where an icon is placed or what the preview looks like, that information isn't something that traditionally in a Unix environment can be saved with a file. It's not part of the operating system. Or
it's
file
a separate
system.
Data file about the file.
So is it
the mail file. And in OS9, in previous, you never knew there were two files.
And that's
there were
I recall
two files there. You just never knew it.
I recall that the ResEdit, which was this application I kind of mentioned in my opener, in OS 9 and before on Macintosh, you could actually see these resources and edit them up and see different forks. Applications had more forks, if you will, than documents, I recall. In any case, you could change an icon inside using that ResEdit.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be equivalent to modifying that dot underscore file.
Right.
Well, that's great to know. So also that means that if I'm like sharing files between a Macintosh and a Windows machine, which I do all the time, I can erase those dot underscore files without damaging the actual information.
The underlying data. It's just that you're not going to be very happy about how things look from the Mac side.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for clearing that frustration up. I appreciate it. And now you're saying that in Tiger, those copy commands and stuff will just take care of it.
Yes.
So now in my Windows machine, if I use command line utilities, I'll have all these files, all these invisible files showing up.
Right. So, yeah. And there are flags to exclude them.
Yeah. Oh, good. They're, good.
But they decide, okay, the right thing to do is, look, if I'm going to copy over, you know, a Word document and that Word document has a resource fork, it better go with it as well.
One of the, in reading your book, I'm reminded of the first time I picked up a Unix help book.
Mm-hmm.
And that book was Scotty Brookie's book, my boss's book.
Oh, Unix for Luddites?
Unix for Luddites, which is in my car right now because I was looking at the differences. When computers started coming online at universities, the interfaces were Unix, and people had to do command line stuff to read their email, and it was hard. And it's nice to see that all that stuff is actually still in there. All those commands are still there.
Oh, sure.
Why?
Yeah, that's there. If you want to use the command line program mail, or you want to use, you know, any other Unix package that you can install, like MUD or Pine, to read your mail, go right ahead. And in fact, I do that. I use the mail.app. I use the mail application that comes with OS X, but I also run a command line version. Then they perfectly happily coexist. I can get the best of both worlds. Usually I prefer dealing with MUT from the command line, but sometimes if I'm dealing with a lot of file attachments, or I'm archiving a lot of files all at once, or a lot of mail messages all at once, I'll use the GUI app.
Now
and it works, you know, they work beautifully together.
When you say work beautifully together, you're talking about the mail command on the in the terminal of OS X allows you to see the information that's actually in mail?
Yeah, or in my case, I use MUT, which is another mail client, but it's a command line-based mail client.
Cool.
That I use through the terminal.
So they're all looking at mbox files, basically?
Actually, using IMAP.
Okay, nice.
Actually, mail does not use mbox format. It puts So MUT doesn't read the mail files directly from mail.app, but they're both using IMAP, accessing a mail server through IMAP.
Right, makes sense.
So I can sit here and from anywhere, be it at work, be it at home, be it on the road, I can use IMAP across the net and have access to those mailboxes.
And IMAP is one of the protocols that allows you to read mail through the internet, the other one being POP3, which most people use.
IMAP, a lot of people use, and POP3 is going to go away pretty soon.
Yeah, IMAP's so much better. That's just how it is. But in any case, you're listening to Geek Speak right now, and we're talking about stuff that's pretty friggin' technical, and we're here to also help you out with your computer problems and answer questions, and we'll be happy to take your questions and comments, and I'll give you those phone numbers in just 1 second. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. On the phone, we have Andy Lester from Illinois, and we're talking about Mac OS X Tiger in a nutshell. We also can handle Perl questions today. In fact, we can answer any question. We just might not be accurate. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can send us email. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us, though. Of course, we appreciate a phone call so we can hear your voice, and we'll put you on air. This program is supported by Cruise.io, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruise.io memberships available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. And this, I'll take this opportunity right now to mention that Cruise.io, the people that actually run Cruise.io, along with one of their premier employees, they started GeekSpeak. They started GeekSpeak in 98. The current Geek Load, myself, Miles, Sean, and so on, took over the show in August of 2000. We've been going for since then. And for quite a while, we were on Monday nights at 6:30, about a half an hour show. It was nice, but we weren't able to do our geek news segment, and we weren't able to have we weren't able to have the depth that we have on this show. Depth on Geek Speak, right? But what's going to happen, and we were then moved to the spot that we're currently in, which is Friday mornings at 10 o'clock, which has been great for all of you listening, and troublesome in a couple ways. You'll notice that right now in the air room, we only have Miles Elam. We don't have Sean, John, Drew, Josh. We don't have a lot of people, and that's because...
And you didn't fly me out.
And we didn't fly out. I know, you're not even here. You're even by phone. But we've been having trouble losing geeks because it's during the work hour. And I always get people contact me and say, you know, I hear the segment of your show while I'm driving to work, but then I'm at work and I got to stop listening. So I want to let everybody know we're announcing today the great news that GeekSpeak will be moving to Saturdays at 10 o'clock. Saturdays from 10 to 11, right after Dr. Don's show. And that will take place on January 7th, will be the first show that we're in that spot. I'm looking forward to the move. The station's excited about it. We're going to stack up really great with Dr. Don's show, which is, of course, a premier health care show. And we get to have the geeks back. And we get to have you listen even while you're not working, which would be kind of nice. So 10 o'clock on Saturday, starting in January, GeekSpeak from 10 to 11. Just want to make that announcement now, and we'll tell you a little bit more about it as we go. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geek this morning is Miles Elam, the remote geek, and our guest is Andy Lester, Mac OS X Tiger in a Nutshell author. And of O'Reilly Publishing. And I appreciate you being here so far with us on the phone. I want to delve in as we're waiting for calls, or actually when we start switching over calls. Again, the phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Andy, when we've been speaking for the last week, I found out that you were actually a Perl expert. And so being someone that uses Perl and kind of likes the environment, let's talk a little about what you do for this community-based programming language environment, if you will.
Well, actually, I'm on the steering committee for the Perl Foundation, which is a nonprofit group that that promotes the use of Perl and helps people, you know, find out about and use, you know, what is certainly my favorite language and community. I'm in charge of PR for them, actually. And so we sponsor conferences. We sponsor projects. We were integrated with Google on their Summer of Code project. I don't know if you guys talked about that over the summer. We had a number of very successful projects that we helped coordinate. So all sorts of community things the Perl Foundation helps organize and contribute to.
Cool. So you keep the community alive, make sure that people know how to use it and how to communicate about using it and how to grow it.
Well, and part of it is, you know, the Perl's always had this sort of shadow over it of being a scripting language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's great for sysadmins. You can write really nice little shell scripts using Perl, and it's sort of gotten short shrift, partly because of that name, scripting, as sort of a toy language. I mean, yeah,
right.
You can do a lot of weird, crazy stuff with it, but, you know, you don't look at real companies doing real applications using this. Amazon runs on Perl using a package called Mason. Ticketmaster.com, which, you know, if you want to talk about a real web app, and if you've ever had to buy tickets on a Saturday morning at 10 o'clock to see, you know, Sticks at the United Center, that, you know, that's what you need to, that, you know, they're dealing with however many millions of transactions a minute. I mean, that's real power. I mean, that's right. A real language that we're dealing with here. So we're trying to get the word out about things like that, about certainly the financial industry is doing a ton of work with Perl, because in the day-to-day business of the financials markets, the kind of speed of development that Perl affords is absolutely crucial. And especially here in the Chicago area, there are dozens of firms down in the city that have, you know, dozens of programmers working in Perl all day. So, I mean, it's my big concern with my new public relations hat is getting Perl out of that little sort of, you know, sysadmin scripting ghetto that I think it's been stuck in for a while.
Great. Okay. Well, let's continue our discussion about Perl a little bit more, but let's go ahead and start taking some calls because
sure.
We've got lots of people waiting. Todd from Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yeah, hi, guys.
Hi, what's your question?
So, basically, what's going on with my web browser here? I have Firefox, and one day, all of a sudden, I wasn't able to log on to anything. So I can still surf the web. That works fine. And but when I go to log on to Hotmail, I get an error saying you can't do that.
What's the error say? Broken?
Let's see here. Real quick, I can...
Is this whenever you push a form button?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Let's see.
Are you on Windows or Mac?
Windows.
Mm-hmm. All right. How do we erase the preferences for Firefox on Windows, Miles? Go.
Well, I can tell you, wiping them all out, that's not necessarily a good idea.
Thing. Right.
It says unable to connect.
Huh.
On Firefox.
But you can browse websites, no problem?
Yes. On the other one, Windows Explorer or whatever, it just gives me an error message.
Internet Explorer also gives a message?
Yeah. I tried that just to, you know, experiment, and it said,
by the way,
it cannot be displayed.
I just have to admit, you've gladdened my heart by hearing you refer to Internet Explorer as the other browser.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Andy, do you have some input on this? Got some thoughts being a web expert?
I really don't. Not without knowing the specific message.
This is a pretty
that it said.
This is a pretty impressive error. I mean, you're on a Windows environment, so viruses are always good things to check for.
Yeah.
But I think that have you recently upgraded anything?
No. Here's the thing. Speaking of viruses, though, I went to check on my Norton internet, you know, the internet security,
mm-hmm.
and nothing works. All of a sudden, it seems like out of the blue.
It's kind of fascinating that you can actually browse the internet, and yet everything else that seems to be is being restricted.
Anything that involves logging in.
It seems like you're under a weird firewall rule where a GET request through port 80 works, but anything else does.
Yeah, but certain traffic is going through because you're able to visit some sites, right?
Right. Visiting a site is equivalent to, well, it's requesting information. Whenever you do a post, you're actually sending a different kind of HTTP command.
Yeah, but it's still the same thing. I mean, it's the same ports,
but there are things that restrict the kind of traffic. Can you visit a secure website?
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Maybe it's got 443 blocked.
Yeah, that's the thing, is those posts sometimes will actually be secure. You'll switch over to secure when you do that post. So it's
what's
possible.
Your ISP?
I don't
is
think
it possible
I can
that your ISP
your website?
Has something blocked.
Yeah, so what is your ISP? Todd?
Yeah.
What internet service provider do you have?
It's local. It's basically our landlord's son has a server.
The landlord's son.
That's
ISP.
The thing. he's got something on that's restricting some kind of traffic.
Oh really? Okay.
Yeah.
He's probably got a proxy server.
Yeah, probably a proxy server running. What you want to do is make
eat
some,
them up.
First, make some cookies, invite them over, and you know, give him some cookies and eggnog and go, look, we got to figure this out. And he'll be able to figure it out with you. And if he's, yeah, I would highly recommend having a good relationship with your system administrator.
Okay.
That's always a good thing to do.
Now, here's the thing.
Andy and Todd, it's actually hard for you to hear each other. So, right. Andy, what are you going to say?
I was just going to say that I don't know if, and you suggested bringing munchies down to the ISP guy, but I don't know if Todd actually has cookies enabled.
That's true. Okay, I'm so sorry to let you say that. All right, Todd, good luck.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, we got lots of calls, so we're just going to keep on going. I'll just mention that Josh Weiss just joined us. Josh, hi.
How's it going, Lyle?
Josh is one of the geeks here at the station that keeps things flowing, and we're moving over to new systems, so he's been very busy doing training. And, Josh, I'm hoping that you'll still be interested in coming to work on Saturdays to come and join us sometimes on GeekSpeak.
Sometimes.
Okay. So we'll keep on taking some calls. Adam from Monterey, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yep, this is Adam. I'm a Windows user in Thunderbird. A couple of days ago, my profiles disappeared. And it keeps asking me to create a new account. And that's a bummer because I can't find all my old emails.
Did you do anything weird like upgrade Windows or install a new version? Kind of happened out of the blue?
Yep.
Okay, well, I would first off say that there could be some hardware problems going on, so be wary that something else might happen bad. Like if it couldn't reach your profile folder, it might have just created another one, and the reason it couldn't reach your profile folder is because something bad happened. That's possible.
Okay.
So you want to keep an eye on it, for example. The next thing
is... like, in other words, starting to lose sectors of the hard drive or something?
Yeah, possibly, or just read error. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So what I want to say is that, first off, are you using POP3 or IMAP?
I believe POP3.
Okay, that's a problem. So that's one of the things that, you know, we were just talking about how, you know, IMAP's superior and POP3 is going to go away, and probably 98% of everyone listening went, what does that mean? And I don't even care, and I'm confused to why I'm listening to this show because I don't know what they're talking about. So let me just clarify that POP3 or Post Office Protocol, something like that?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
It's the client, the Thunderbird thing, the email client, actually goes and gets all the mail from the server and erases it from the server and puts it on your local computer. And, yeah, you've got your mail. But if something happens to your local computer, you don't have your mail anymore. There's no copies of it anywhere. IMAP, or Internet Mail Exchange Protocol?
Internet Message Access Protocol.
No, mumble.
Well, with POP3, though, you can leave stuff on the server.
You can leave stuff, but it's a mess. So what happens with IMAP is everything stays on the server, and you get copies of it. And then if you move to different computers, your mail always stays the same. There's a synchronization that happens automatically. It's like the first synchronization of content. And it's a great way to use your email because normally... not in all cases, the ISP that provides you the mail service has backups and makes sure that information doesn't get lost from the server.
Right. The drawback for the ISP, though, is that they have to invest in hard drives to hold all of this email for all their customers.
But hard drives are cheap. And lots of companies will do this, especially right now where not a lot of people are using IMAP. So the thing is, right now, your mail is in some modified, damaged profile on your computer, and that mail possibly is completely gone. Do you do backups of your system regularly?
I do not.
I mean, it's also
not on this particular computer.
It is possible that Thunderbird got confused and is pointing to the wrong place for those profiles.
Totally.
So, I mean, it could be on the hard drive and safe
to find it.
Yeah, I mean,
So the next thing is, does anyone know, anyone in the room, or Andy, do you know the path structure of Thunderbird on a Windows machine?
Windows documents and settings.
Application support. Not application support.
Application data.
Application data.
Mozilla.
So go into document settings and then go into your username. And start looking around and hope that you find some other folder. Somewhere in there, there's going to be Thunderbird or Mozilla, and then inside that, it's going to have profile.
It's Mozilla, and then Thunderbird, and then profile.
Document, right.
I could have
settings,
it was Mozilla
one more time.
Oh, whatever. Documents
and settings, the username that you use to log into your computer, and then start exploring. We don't know exactly where it is. But you're gonna finally find a folder called profiles, and inside there is going to be, hopefully, a folder that has a strange profile name. And what you can do is... first, as soon as you find that, copy it somewhere. Make a copy of it, okay? Because inside there is your entire mail structure. Then go ahead and allow the Thunderbird to make a new profile for you, And after you do that, shut down the profile and then go look at the differences and see if you can copy the content back in. This is all hacking, and it's just going to be difficult. Well, and good luck.
Can't Thunderbird load a profile? I mean, couldn't he in some sense actually load that profile
open
into Thunderbird?
Open and load is a good idea. Yeah. So the other thing to do is when you copy that file that you find in your profiles folder to your desktop or something, then go into Firefox and say, when it comes to new profile, whatever, say open and then go find it on your desktop. It's possible that it can't read it in the current location or it's not aware of it. But I think you might just be out of luck here.
Oh, man. See, I'm listening to all of this. I'm going, we're doing a public service?
Well, we're telling him how to find it if it's there.
Oh, man.
If by chance. Pledge week.
What's that, Andy?
Good thing this isn't during
pledge. No kidding.
Oh, man.
Good thing I'm not pushing it. We're changing to a new time because the show's so great. No, that's not. All right. We're going to. Well, I don't know who this is. Is this Tom or George? First off, thank you, Todd, for the call. Or was it Andy?
Adam.
Adam, thanks for the call. Goodbye. Tom or George, hello?
Yes, this is George. Thank you.
Hello, George. Welcome to Geekspeak.
Thank you very much. I have a question about XP Home. Mm-hmm. My sister has it. I'm of no use whatsoever in this regard. She doesn't really know how to use it. I was hoping the Geeks could recommend some titles that I might buy for her that would be user-friendly, that would see her through.
You mean books?
Are you talking books?
Yes.
What is she using it for?
I'm not entirely certain. She's in Detroit for email and whatnot, I guess.
Just real basic.
So she wants to just a better understanding of the operating system and how to use it?
Yes.
Does she feel lost or something? Or?
I think so.
Okay. So you want a good XP Home reference book. Okay, Andy, does O'Reilly have one?
There are a number of, O'Reilly publishes the Missing Manual series, which is...
Oh, yeah, that's a great series.
And they talk about, and it is exactly aimed at that market. Hold on.
Looks like he's in a very
busy... I'm sitting here looking at a copy of Windows XP for Starters by David Pogue.
Uh-huh.
David Pogue is mostly known as a Mac guy. But he's also done a lot of these missing manuals, and it's not too big. I think that'd be a good start.
Okay,
for
so again, the book title is
Windows XP for Starters,
and it's by whom? What
by
publisher?
Post.
David Pogue.
Oh, Pope. Okay.
Pogue. P-O-G-U-E.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you very much for your help.
And Andy, thank you for saving us on that one. I didn't know the book title right away, and I couldn't do the Google search fast enough. We're getting lots of calls, and I want to get it to everybody. So I'm going to make a guess here. I have a little bit of misinformation about who's on the phone, so I'll just say hello and let you answer.
This is Steve from Santa Cruz.
Steve from Santa Cruz. Welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question?
Well, I'm not using Tiger yet. I've got a small network here in my home office, and I'm using... Panther and still Jaguar. I would like to be able to set something up so that whenever a new file or a new folder is created on a system, that there will be the certain permissions that will allow administrative access or just not have any permissions.
Right.
It's such a pain in the butt trying to share these files and always having to go in and change the permissions on them once they're created. Is there a way to do that?
From the command line side?
Well, either way, either from the GUI side or the command line.
Well, from the command line side, the command you want is umask.
Uman?
Umask.
No, umask. U-M-A-S-K. That basically, that lets you restrict certain permissions on any file you create. What it does is it masks out certain permission bits and saves, and so that... If you know, look, I know that whenever I create a file, I don't want it to be world readable.
Mm-hmm.
You can set your umask to say, okay, fine, never create world readable files.
So is the umask going to control what that current user's settings are for creating
yes.
files? Oh, that's
yes.
how you do that. Okay, that's good to
right.
know.
it masks out certain bits that you don't want to have set on by default.
Does it also define what the group of that file will be?
No, it doesn't.
What defines that?
What the
You mean to have
that's your group when you create the file.
Okay, so your parent group, if you will, the group that is your main group. Okay.
Right. Your main group.
So does this answer your question, Steve?
Will this also work on the folders that are created as opposed to
files? Right, because in Unix a folder is a file.
Okay.
There is no difference between permission-wise between a directory and a folder.
Except that files,
a directory and a file.
Yeah, except files and directories, you want to have different permissions.
Right.
For example, the XKeep bit works differently for a file than a directory. So.
Right. If you want to be able to change into a directory, you need to have the execute bit set on.
This is so clear. Thank you. Okay, Steve, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I'll try it out. Thank
All right,
you.
Good luck. Look up UMAX. UMask, excuse me. Okay, from Watsonville, Alice, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Well, hello.
Hello.
I've been wanting to call you for a long time, but I've always been very much afraid to. Cause
good, because we're mean.
Well, be nice to a grandmother Mac lover.
All right.
I started with an Apple IIe Enhanced. Years ago.
That's not even a Mac. That's great.
Yeah. That's one of the first ones they built. So I self-taught. So don't ask me any really bad questions.
Okay.
Because I probably can't answer them. Anyway, I'm going to have to upgrade to Operating System 10 shortly. And this week I got a message that my Internet Explorer would no longer be available on Macintosh ever after December 31st. So what would be a good extra browser besides AOL, which is what I have? Because AOL hardly supports Macintosh anyway. I think their AOL is like 5 point, and they will not upgrade it and never plan to upgrade it. So the browser for AOL is really poor.
So at this point, you need to step back, take a deep breath, and relax, because there is no problem. When you go to OS X, you will have a browser called Safari. And it is a wonderful browser and is better than Internet Explorer on the Mac. And it
is a very Mac-like browser.
Yeah.
It's integrated with everything. It makes everything browser-wise very painless.
So basically, when you move to OS X, you'll be okay. But are you still going to be using AOL?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, you'll be happy to know that AOL has not abandoned the Mac. They just abandoned the old Macintoshes.
Oh.
They still produce new stuff for OS X.
Right, just you can get
Internet
Explorer.
Well, now, do I have to notify them that I upgraded, or do they just...
The biggest thing, do you have an AOL disk with you, a new one that's been mailed to you in the mail?
No.
Okay, go visit a neighbor, because there's thousands of them. They're all around you.
If you just walk outside, you'll stumble over one.
Well, I have a neat little guy from Santa Cruz that comes down and does all this for me.
So tell him that you're going to be upgrading and that you want to make sure that he has the most recent AOL offerings, and it'll have Macintosh OS X.
Because when I bought this iMac in 2001, it came with an Operating System 10 disk of its own.
Right.
And we opted to put the 9 in then.
Okay, we'll definitely switch over to OS X. You'll have a major learning curve. Have some time involved in doing this, because it's different.
But I need another Pogue book.
But once you accept that change is inevitable, you'll love it.
Oh, I'm sure I will. I've gone all through this already since my enhanced 2E.
I think it's great that you've moved from the 2E enhanced all the way, and you're about to do OS X. That's great.
We bought the 2E when we were overseas. We bought it at a Navy exchange when we lived overseas.
Oh, cool.
And then we went to Hong Kong and bought all the printer and all the stuff, you know. And then we had to go through the rigmarole of getting all that stuff to change the voltage.
Oh, right. Because all the settings were wrong.
Everything.
Well,
anyway, I've loved them. I wouldn't have anything else. My kids want me to get Windows. Never.
Great. Good,
I love
Alice.
It.
Stick to it. I think that switching operating systems is not something anyone should take lightly. Alice, good luck on the move to OS X.
Thank you so much, and I'm so glad I called.
Please have no fears of calling again.
I will do that.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take another call right away, and we're going to get back into Pearl after this. Kevin from Lompico, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I just installed 10.4 into a Macintosh D5, and slowly I started to get slowdowns, to make a pun, in, say, communication with the printer, functions in Photoshop and so on. And I'm wondering if I'm more likely to solve these problems by trying to get a copy of 10.4 point whatever, the updated version of it, or by getting new drivers for the printer or another.
What did you just install? What's the difference you just did?
I installed 10.4 over 10.3 in the I guess, you know, Tiger over whatever cat name they had.
And you didn't upgrade kind of install. And you're running
a G5 in the black box and shoved it in the drive and
you're running a G5, did you say?
Yeah, the dual processor aluminum frame computer that they've been selling.
All right. Well, I know exactly who could answer this question. They're not on the phone right now with us. They're not on air with us. But I think you should definitely upgrade to the most recent 10.4.3. Absolutely. And the way you do that is just go over the Apple system software upgrade.
Yeah, if I had a high-speed connection, which I may someday soon, but I don't at the moment.
I would recommend doing it anyway and just letting it, it'll take a long time, so you just do it.
Yeah, about 9 hours.
Yeah, you start doing it when you go to sleep, and the next morning you see that it's an error, and you try to get it.
Well, when that deadline occurs, if there's been any corruption in it, does it have any self-checking function?
Yes, it checks the archives after it's downloaded.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
It checks the archives.
Okay, to make sure there's not a flaw in
them. Yeah, the one thing that you want to make sure when you do that upgrade, are you doing any video editing?
Occasionally, yeah.
Okay, then don't upgrade QuickTime to the most recent version of QuickTime yet. Just leave that.
Yeah, I heard about that, right.
And hopefully you'll be able to not do QuickTime.
Just avoid hitting on that one.
But I think it makes sense for you to upgrade. I mean, the slowdown, I don't know what it's caused by.
Yeah, right.
And, check how big your hard drive is, how much space you have left on it. That's an important thing to do. You can do that by control-clicking on your hard drive icon on the desktop and saying get info, and it'll tell you how much space is left. If you're anything less than, 400 megs, you have a problem.
I think there's more than that in there. By the way, do these do defragmentation automatically, or do you still need to buy a second-party defragmentation
program? No, if you keep them on every once in a while during the night, they'll do it by themselves.
So the operating system will automatically defrag.
Yeah, I don't know if it defrags, it definitely cleans it up. I'm assuming the monthly is a defrag as well.
Yeah, different animal than the Windows world, so not everything is a direct analogy. It
cleans itself up. How's that?
Okay.
Yeah.
The way that Unix stores the files is very different than the way Windows stores the files.
Yeah.
So the fragmentation is much less of an issue.
Cool. That's good to know. All right, thank you very much for the call.
Sure, thank you.
All right, let's get back. I'm not taking any more calls because we're running out of time, but let's talk a little bit more, Andy, with you. Why is it that you love Perl so much?
It's fun. And if you're not programming for fun, then it's just another job. But, I love what I do. I love programming, and no other language lets me have as much fun and get as much stuff done as quickly as Perl does. It's always been a love affair ever since I discovered it.
And for the audience, Perl was written by a linguist, right? Not a
Larry Wall. Yes.
Yeah.
And he is a linguist by training. And a lot of the people who are involved with Perl, and certainly with the Perl development of Perl 6, which is the major rewrite coming up, human language is a big part of it. We try to express things in the most fluid lingual way that we can.
Because the truth of the matter is, any language that's being written it's called a language because it is that.
It is a language.
And you want it to work for the person writing it, not for the computer. That's the important thing, is that a person understands it. But I got to say that there's a thing that happens every year, I think, maybe it doesn't happen anymore, is making Perl, obfuscating Perl. It's like make a small Perl's program that you can't open and understand very easily that does something cool.
Sure.
I mean, there's a whole undercurrent to the Perl community of doing really complicated, lingually impossible things in Perl. Do you do that kind of stuff?
No, but I appreciate it when I see it.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that was always my thing with Perl, was that it always seemed to me like a write-only language.
It can be. Just like any language can be a write-only language. One of the things that I would absolutely recommend for anybody who is looking at using Perl as a real tool, as a real language, is a book by Damien Conway called Perl Best Practices.
Good book. You know, I'm going to have to cut you short.
Okay.
I really appreciate you coming on. The book is Macintosh OS 10 Tiger in a Nutshell. There are other books by Andy. Andy Lester, thank you very much for joining us today on GeekSpeak. Goodbye.
Thanks for having me.
Goodbye. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton offering computer rentals, printing design, shipping, delivered office supplies, Notary Public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. For our weekly Reporters Roundtable, Monday morning's Talk of the Bay, host Wes Sims is joined by Shannon McCond of... a staff writer for the Santa Cruz Sentinel, and Ken McLaughlin of the Santa Cruz Mercury News, as they recall the top news stories in Santa Cruz for 2005. Then KUSP's Rick Kleffel, great guy, talks with Tim Pratt about The Strange Adventures of Ranger Girl, his novel of the Old West and the supernatural set entirely in Santa Cruz. That's on Talk of the Bay, Monday mornings at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP. GeekSpeak is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is also supported by Natural Selection Furniture. Natural Selection Furniture is open Tuesday through Sunday at 607 Soquel Avenue between Ocean Street and Branca 40 in Santa Cruz, and online at naturalselectionfurniture.com. Next week, we'll still be on Fridays, even though in January we'll be moving on to Saturdays. Next week, we're going to be doing a whole show about technical gifts on the 23rd. So it doesn't give you a lot of time to buy those gifts, but that's what we'll be doing next week on GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and used by permission. The Geeks this morning, Josh and Miles, thank you both for joining me. Rick is our phone answer. I thank him. And stay tuned on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH Santa Otto, or on the web at KUSP.org for the open road. I'm Lyle Troxell for KUSP.